Okay, so hello everybody. I'm Adrian Wills and I'm interviewing on behalf of eBrain. I'm delighted to welcome Matt Eagles. He's 53. He is head of patient voice at a health communication company. And Matt, I'm really grateful to you for spending the time with us. Before we get on to the illness that came on that you experienced from a fairly young age, I just want to ask you a little bit, maybe, about your family background and if you remember anything, of your childhood before you developed Parkinson's, if you could tell us a bit about that.
Well, good morning, Adrian, first of all. Yes, I can actually. My family background is quite odd because I was actually adopted from Liverpool at 18 weeks old. I actually know very little about my birth parents, apart from my birth mother was a trainee teacher. And my birth father was an engineering student at Liverpool University. And of course, in the late 60s, getting pregnant and giving birth and not being married was frowned upon. So my mother had gave me up. I don't know how willingly or unwillingly, but she did. But I was adopted by a family who've always brought me up, and the only family I can ever remember. They've been brilliant. Now, they noticed, I think it was actually my neighbour that noticed when I was about six or so. And I was like, it was actually my headmaster too at my infant and sort of primary school who noticed I couldn't stand up in assembly. I kept on falling back and losing my sense of balance. I had swimming lessons. I couldn't swim properly. I kept on, I describe it as, frogs in springtime when they're in a pond and they kind of like float around, but their legs dangle down on the in the water. That was how I was trying to swim. But no, I found it really difficult. I was very sporty at a young age. And I found I suddenly became a lot slower than the rest of the guys. I used to play junior rugby. My dad and my uncle used to come and watch me. And I just couldn't keep up with the other players. And my dad, nobody knew why. It was very, very odd. I couldn't balance, as I said. And I think the turning point for my mother came when I was about, I think, six or seven, in the mid-70s anyway, when my mother used to cut my toenails on the corner of the toilet bowl every Sunday, and there was a towel rail just to the side of me. Which is old and rickety, but the towels sort of had always been there, and I kept on trying to grab onto it because I couldn't balance on one leg. And Mum was going, thought I was messing around, and was kind of slapping me and said, "Stop it, Matthew! Stop being silly!" And I was in tears, you know, I couldn't balance, and from there, the whole journey unraveled, really.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. So, I mean, obviously, it's a long time ago, but what do you remember about how long it took to make the right diagnosis? What you kind of went through waiting, and also interestingly, given such a long time ago, can you remember what the doctors told you? Because I could imagine they might not have told you everything that they told your parents, or vice versa. What do
Well,
you remember about that?
this is the whole ethos of it, Adrian. I have seen my GP's digital medical records or my own digital medical records, and it actually says Parkinson's disease in an entry on my seventh birthday. But to me, I was in hospital in the from the late about 76, 77, all virtually every single summer. While they conducted investigations, I guess, to try and prove it wasn't Parkinson's. I mean, I hadn't got a clue what it was, and to be quite honest, Adrian, I didn't really care. I just wanted to be out with my friends. If they'd have, I don't think they've ever re I can't remember, and probably because I wasn't listening at the time anyway. I just wanted to, I was just, I can remember being at appointments and just sort of sitting on a chair, which is possibly too big for me, and wiggling my legs and looking at how I didn't care. I just really, really wanted to be out of there.
Yeah.
So it was my, I think the diagnosis side was a burden that my parents really, really felt more than I did. To me, it was just a damning convenience. I couldn't keep up with my friends. Although it didn't stop me trying. So I think it was when I was about in 77, I think, when I was eventually put on Cinemet by a doctor, and it was purely a shot in the dark. A guy, I remember his name, Dr. Liversidge, because he offered me 50 pence to take this medication. And of course, I didn't care what it was. I'd got money. And in 1977, 50p was quite a lot of money.
I remember, yeah.
Particularly to me as a small boy. And I was like, my eyes lit up and said, you know, of course I'll take this cinema three times a day at the age of eight. You know, that's...
Can you remember what difference it made initially? I mean, was it really good, or...?
It gave me a stability, really. And in the early stages, you know, it was pretty unpredictable when I didn't know about on and off, and I didn't know anything about Parkinson's, and I didn't even want to. There was no way of really looking into the facts, and to be quite honest, Adrian, it didn't interest me. I just wanted to get on with my life. My parents, on the other hand, probably didn't want to burden me with a diagnosis of a disease of old age, essentially. So, yeah.
Just before you tell me a bit more about that, can I just ask you, so once you sort of realised what it was, and, you know, maybe by that stage you were taking the cinema, I mean, you're obviously quite a bright lad. You went to Macclesfield Grammar School. How did your schoolmates react to you? Do you know, was it difficult, or were they, you know, what was it like?
Well, do you know, I think I blanked out some of the bad things that happened, because subsequently people I've been at school with have come back to me and been really said, I'm sorry for bullying you, etc. But I actually don't, I've either blocked it out of my mind or don't remember it. It was the teachers. I went to the King's School in Macclesfield. And in year seven it would be now, or the third form as it was then, I had a Latin teacher who called me dead legs. I had a history teacher that called me sparrow legs. I had a teacher that made me lie down on the floor in front of the blackboard on my back for the whole lesson because I was late for class, and two of my colleagues thought it was really funny to sort of drag me in by my armpits. And then she was an old school teacher, an old school mathematics teacher. And I can remember quite clearly saying, we had these sort of all-in-one sort of individual desks, wooden desks, wooden and metal desks, which you lifted up like that and put down. And because I'd grown up with Parkinson's, I was very strong, so all I needed to do was just haul myself into the seat and stay there. But she insisted on me lying on the floor on that. So my lovely blue blazer was covered in chalk dust. As far as my friends were concerned, I can remember this because I can remember my sports teacher laughing at me because I used to love playing football. And I still, well, I can't now, but I still love football. But I remember diving for trying to save a ball. And it had actually already gone in the net when I dived, because my reactions were that slow. And I can remember my teacher just laughing at me. But I think it was a situation where I knew I was just trying my best to do things. And I was always last to be picked as well for teams.
I know the feeling.
But I played rugby, I played tennis. All through my sort of Parkinson's journey as a young boy and as a teen, I tried to play as much sport as I could simply because I loved it.
And after school, did you go on to university, and what did you do after school?
I did actually, yes, but I probably took too much notice of what my mother wanted me to do rather than what I was actually good at. Because throughout school, it's a very, very early age, Adrian. I've had elocution lessons and speech and drama lessons, which meant I was entered into speech and drama festivals, which meant I was sat in front of, not stood, and every other child in the classes was stood, but I was sat on a seat in front of an audience, reciting poems, being competitive, playing to an audience, if you like. And I used to read in assembly at school. I was in the school choir, added readings in church services. So I was quite confident in speaking in front of lots of people, despite the fact I had to sit down to do it. So my mother thought I'd make a great barrister. So I ended up doing a business law degree and an LLB business law degree in the City of London Polytechnic. However, I became a student and I was living away from home and I had my freedom. So I kind of enjoyed the extracurricular activities rather too much. But also, I think it was a case of, it was an awful lot of effort in, and I knew it what would be. I couldn't keep up with writing up notes in the lectures.
Okay, yeah.
And also, it was a bit of a nightmare, exam time, because I had a scribe. Now, I'm sure you know, being a qualified neurologist as you are, doing lots of exams, but having to dictate your answers, is very, very tiring. When you've got five essays to dictate to somebody sat next to you who's writing, you can't read yourself.
Yeah.
I got really cheesed off with the whole course. And in the end, I avoided doing some exams in my second year and got asked to vacate my place on the course. I don't say kicked out, but I was, basically.
Mm-hmm.
After 3 years, because I repeated some first year exams, which I passed. And then I was enjoying myself. I was going to watch West Ham every game and I was basically having a good time.
Mm.
But to be quite honest, I was also getting, not political, but I was very disillusioned by the fact that when we did some mock legal cases, and I was arguing as a barrister against one of my other course mates, I was winning the cases, not because my point of law was correct, but because I was more confident at arguing my case and picking holes in their case because of my background in speech and drama.
Yeah.
And I thought, this is wrong. So I lost a bit of faith in, and I still believe in the legal system that it's not a question of how right you are, it's how good an actor your barrister can be.
Yeah, I think a lot of people would agree with that. I want to ask you then, so you end up studying in London, and I know that you were seen at the National Hospital, and you ended up having deep brain stimulation at quite an early time in the development of that treatment. I mean, what do you remember about that? And also, I was very interested to ask you what difference it made to you when it was all fixed up and everything.
Well, first of all, I remember the exact moment. It was a guy called Professor Niall Quinn was there, and he suggested this treatment simply because I was taking so many Madopar at the time, and I'd tried a lot of the other treatments, but I was going from being incredibly dystonic to being incredibly twitchy, and there was very little in between times. Like I said, I tried the apomorphine pump. I tried all sorts. I tried patches. I tried all sorts. However, I always trust my specialist implicitly. So if he advises anything, I believe it's in my best interests. Mm-hmm. So I said, yeah, go ahead if it's going to help me. And because, I mean, basically my life was, I've always worked. So my work, but I lived with my parents quite a long time, simply because they were helping look after me, even though I wasn't at the house very often. I was either at work or in the pub or at football. But the decision, I think I tried to hurt my to the outside world. No, it didn't bother me at all, but I think internally it bothered me tremendously. I had a lot more hair back then, by the way. But I'd shaved my head in preparation for the surgery, you know, literally with a razor. And I'd looked in the mirror, and I'd done it 1 or 2 days before I was due into the hospital. And I ended up passing out when they were doing some prep for the surgery. And they were just prepping the stereostatic frame to my head.
Yeah.
And they ended up doing both sides of the surgery, the MRI scan, the initial insertion of the electrode, and putting the stimulation pack in, all in one go.
Okay.
But it's made a tremendous difference to my dignity as much as anything else. I mean, I'd got to the stage where I couldn't get out of bed at night to go for a wee. So when I was in my mid-20s, my friends had saved up for a hospital bed for me. One of my friends was a nurse, a female nurse. And they'd managed to get a proper hospital bed with the side pods in, so I could actually hoik myself over in the middle of the night. Because that was one of the bonuses of having Parkinson's when you're a young kid. Your body grows up to physically adapt to the physicality of the disease. So actually my shoulders, my arms, my chest and everything were actually very, very strong. And I was able to easily lift my body weight about.
Okay.
And that was a good thing. So the DBS helped me because I could get up in the middle of the night afterwards and have a wee in the toilet instead of a bottle at the side of my bed, which doesn't sound much, but to me personally, in my personal dignity, it was huge. Also, the whole aspect of eating, my daily schedule, all of a sudden, after years and years and years of actually waiting to have meals until pretty much before I went to bed on a daily basis, because I didn't want to enjoy my day and my evening, I could eat when everybody else was eating. And it was like, and I put on quite a lot of weight. And I think that's quite common actually after DBS, but yeah, just being able to do regular things at regular times.
Yeah.
Was amazing.
Yeah. So you've obviously had a long experience of the NHS.
Yeah.
What are your feelings about the way it's changed over the years? I mean, for better or worse, what do you feel about that?
I think it's changed. I mean, going digital's helped tremendously for a start. However, until the systems can talk to one another at different hospitals, until patient notes are in their entirety are all digitized properly, then it's a problem. Because I know for a fact a lot of my notes have been lost from the years gone by. I've been going to the National for about well over 30 years now, and a lot of my notes are not there anymore. I used to have a file that was like this. You know, really, but now it's like this, and it's like almost like brand new. So a lot of my data's been lost before it can be copied to before it can be digitized. So digital and digital communication is great. Video appointments are a godsend for me because it saves me over 100 quid coming down and my wife coming down to London. It saves my wife taking a day off work, saves me taking a day off work. And it means I can sit in my office on as it happens, my living room table and chat to my consultant. And if things need doing, which they did last time, I can then make an appointment, come down and physically see somebody.
Yeah. So did that only come in after COVID, or were you able to do video consultations before then?
That only came in after and during COVID.
Yeah.
But I think it's tremendous that obviously if you need a physical examination, it's super difficult. I mean, I know there are lots of wearables now there, because that's what I do in my job. It's my job to know what's going on. And there are, but you can never be a bedside, for want of a better word, a bedside consultation in reality to really assess the situation.
Okay. Now, I just want to, so in spite of your illness, you've obviously led a very full and rich life. You've abseiled, you've skydived, you were a photographer at the Olympics, I believe.
Yes, I was. Oh yes, that was one of my dream things that I did. And that was after DBS, actually. Because it was a year after, I think I did DBS in September. The following April, I went on a safari to Botswana and Zambia and Namibia with my mum and dad. I paid for it, by the way, because I was
very generous.
I paid for myself, I mean. But and I got some brilliant photographs, and I thought, I really like this photography. I'm going to buy a camera. So I bought this, I bought a decent camera. And I'd already been sort of writing match reports for my local football club for years. And I became the press secretary for my East Cheshire Football League, for the Macclesfield District Sunday League, and the Macclesfield FA. So I was doing match reports regularly every weekend, and it took up my whole weekend. And I was writing articles for my local paper as well. But then I decided, look, I can take pictures of the matches as well and provide the full service to the newspaper. So not only was I writing up 20-odd match reports every weekend, but I was going to travelling. And my now wife will tell you this. She now doesn't come to football with me. She was driving me to these games, and I was photographing these games, getting decent shots because I had an eye, because I played the game myself, and I knew the shots I was looking for. Mm-hmm. And basically, it was kind of as a reward for me having written for the... I had a whole page in the newspaper for my reports. And it was as a result of that, one of them... guys I knew who was a football journalist said, why don't you apply to the Olympics and see if you can become a football photographer? And I did. And I got Olympic accreditation via a friend who happened to work for ESPN, SoccerNet. And he said, why don't you go as my photographer?
Wow.
So I said, yeah, sure. And it was the most amazing experience. I did a recce to Old Trafford, where I managed to break my camera first of all. But no, it's what an experience.
Yeah,
I photographed at Wembley three times. I photographed at Old Trafford three times. And I photographed at the Millennium Stadium as well. And I even gate crashed Neymar's. He was being interviewed by, I don't know who it was, but I was trying to find my way out of Wembley Stadium and Neymar was being interviewed, and I like opened this door, and I could see he was being interviewed, and I was like, sorry. But I know,
yeah, you don't want to upset Neymar.
No. What an amazing experience!
That sounds great.
Excuse me.
Can I? Before we finish, can you just tell us a bit? I know you're involved with this website platform, Parky Life.
Parky Life,
I've had a look at it. I think it's great. Can you just tell the listeners a bit more about it?
Yes, absolutely. Parky Life originated after I became aware that so many people, and this is since the digital age has occurred, so many people are ashamed of being seen in public and showing off their symptoms simply because they feel ashamed or upset or whatever. So I decided, having seen a guy at Euston Station in the department where people help you get on the train, the assistance lounge, I was very disconnected, sat one side of the lounge, and I could see a guy. He was also a little bit disconnected, sat opposite me with his wife, looking very sad and very sullen and very sort of, oh, woe is me. So I thought, I'm going to, and there was a seat next to the guy. And I decided to stagger over and said, excuse me, I hope you don't mind me asking, but do you have Parkinson's? And he lifted his head really, really slowly and said, yes, I do. And I went, oh, brilliant, so do I. And he, at that point...
You should be a neurologist.
Well, you know, it's funny. It's like finding, it's like being a dodo and finding another dodo in the wild, you know. You sort of get quite excited because you find you've got some common ground. And anyway, I decided that because I deal with my my everyday by writing quite amusing stories, I thought, and then they were getting illustrated by a colleague at work. I thought, why not combine the two? Let's get some little nuggets of positivity out there. Let's be colourful. Let's not let people feel ashamed or bad about their own diagnosis. So basically, it was predominantly myself. We collected hacks, we collected tips, we collected funny stories, and we had people who were sort of quite major players in the Parkinson's sphere, Parky sphere, as we call it.
Yeah.
And we got artists, and they've all done their work for free, and some of them are quite famous. We approached some agencies, in Manchester and London, where we're based, and they came up with the trumps. We sent them briefs, we sent them what we wanted from them, and every card has been done by a different artist, and that is to represent the differences in Parkinson's. And we made it, I have some here, the deck of positive thinking from the Parkinson's community. It's positive. The reason they're cards as well is because you can turn what could potentially be an awkward situation into something fun and bright and colourful. And this is one that's on card here. Seek out those who've walked in your shoes. They're the fountain of knowledge and the best support ever. And it's just little nuggets of positivity that you might not necessarily think of that help the community, but they're provided by healthcare professionals. They're provided by speech therapists. They're provided by people who care for people with Parkinson's. So it's for the whole community. One of my favourite ones is my T-shirt that I wear, which gets more traction than anything else. And I make no apologies for the wording on it. I don't know whether you can see this.
Yeah, no. So I'm going to read it out for this. It says, I'm not pissed. I've got Parkies.
Now, that I wear it often when I'm out at events, and it always invites conversation. In fact, I was at the British Superbike meeting at Alton Park, and I was just sat on my mobility scooter, and a guy came up to me and said, brilliant, that I want one of those. And you said, thank you for sharing, thank you for being so brave and wearing it. And it kind of explains things, because obviously, as you know well know, Adrian, people who have Parkinson's, their symptoms make them look like they're drunk, staggering around all the time. This, I mean, some people, the people that get offended by that teacher aren't people with Parkinson's.
Yeah, no, I get that. Yeah.
And in fact, very few people have, and I have a brilliant. In fact, I had the riders at the British Superbikes asking for photographs with me rather than the other way around because I like the T-shirt so much. But I think the message that I'd really like to send across is don't be afraid of showing off who you are, because it puts, if you try and hide away, and it's Mental Health Awareness Week, as we know, it puts a tremendous burden on you mentally, sort of try and hide symptoms or hide what is actually happening to you. And I think because I'm always so open, I mean, I have, don't get me wrong, I have had my own mental health issues. I have suffered depression, etc. But I've made a pact with myself to be a positivity activist, because nobody really likes to be around people who are sad and don't want to do anything. So I think if you're positive and you're sort of vibrant, or as vibrant as you can, you will attract others of the same type. And I encourage people to try and be their best and try and be positive and smile. And I know it's difficult, and it's a horrible disease, but hey, you can get some positives out of it.
Yeah. So Matt, that's a really fantastic positive message to end on. So let me just conclude by saying I'm incredibly grateful to you for giving up your time. That was a really interesting summary of of your life, really, and I'm very grateful to you for participating in this. Thank you very much.
No, thank you, and it's been very kind of you. Thank you for inviting me.